Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, you are listening to The Three Questions with Andy Richter, and I am delighted to have, it's almost ridiculous how nice this person is. It's almost like he's one of the nicest people in show business to the point where I think there's got to be bodies buried somewhere because he's just too nice. I'm talking about Josh Gondelman, the hilarious stand-up writer, now running a show, got a book coming out. Wow, you're everywhere.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling me both nice and in show business.
Well, what else are you?
I guess I am.
You have to admit it. Does it make you feel uncomfortable? Like, does it make you feel like,
well, I feel
boastful?
I did comedy for so long, and I wonder if you feel this way, but I was in comedy for so long, right, as a stand-up without feeling remotely in show business.
Yes.
And now I have to be like, oh, I do both of those things.
Yes, yes. Like, no, I mean, for me, it's been long enough. I mean, I have the embarrassment of riches of having had a television job very early in my life. I think I was 27.
Oh, wow.
When the Conan show started. And I had, and before that I had even, you know, I had been in the movie Cabin Boy, and I'd been in another movie. Now being in show business to me is, it's what I do.
Yes.
It's my profession. It's my craft. It's my industry. But I do not have, I'm always still a little bit taken aback when somebody, and this is a beautiful thing about my job, is that I was on a show that was as meaningful to young comedy people as the shows that were meaningful to me when I was a young comedy person. I'm thrilled that I'm on a formative show for a new generation.
Absolutely.
Of comedians. But it's weird when I meet them and they treat me like some sort of grand dame.
Sure.
I just am like, no, listen, I'm just you plus time. I'm just old. But I'm you. I'm exactly you.
Comedy equals tragedy plus time.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then show business equals comedy
yes,
plus time.
Is, yeah, just being on stage and slinging comedy hash. Well, Josh, you know the deal here. There are three questions.
I do.
Where do you come from? Where are you going? What have you learned? Are you prepared?
I am.
To spill your guts?
I've thought about it.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. You don't need to, but I'm glad you did.
No. They're also, imagine if I didn't have the answers to at least two of those three
questions.
Right,
right.
Just like, where do you come from? Just like, oh, shit.
I was not ready
for
this.
I don't know. I had a head injury. I don't remember.
I woke up in this studio.
Yeah, yeah.
I think maybe I'm like one of those guys that's going to be activated as a super spy. That's right. Where I think I come from. I think I'm kind of a Jason Bourne.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine if Jason Bourne, maybe this is the plot of one of them, I haven't seen them all, just kind of like let himself go. And then when he activated, he just like pulled a hamstring immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Or if like when he was unactivated, like he became a stand-up.
Holy shit,
we just wrote a blockbuster.
Yeah, this is so good.
Holy fuck, that is a blockbuster.
And then, right, he's on stage.
Stand-up comedian becomes activated from his previous life as a...
And then now there's like a famous
person. Can we record
person?
Another day? Because I need to write this.
Yeah, I gotta go. Right. He hears like a snap of his fingers while he's on stage, and all of a sudden it's famous comedian murders 11 audience members.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's just like, yeah, or like he sees someone in the audience that like, holy shit, it's, you know,
yeah,
it's Drago Corinthian. Yep, yep. And I have to go kill him, you know. you are from Massachusetts.
I am from Massachusetts.
You're one of those people.
I'm one of those
New Englanders.
Yeah, one of those salty towny types.
From Stoneham, years and years and years.
From
Stoneham?
Yeah. Stoneham, Massachusetts.
And your family's been there forever. Yep. Yeah.
My parents still live in the house that I grew up in.
Yeah.
And they were from not neighboring towns, but nearby towns. They grew up separately in nearby towns. So like very Massachusetts. My grandparents lived there. And their parents, I believe, some of them had come from other places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And where are the other places?
Like Russia, Poland.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. You're Jewish?
Jewish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what is the family business? What are you all in up there?
So I was in my mom's family business for a long time before and during the beginning of comedy. My mom was an educator.
Oh, wow.
For years, yeah. And she was the director of a small private school that was like toddler through eighth grade, I think, kind of at its most expansive.
Yeah.
And I was an assistant there in the summers, and I taught Spanish there for my last two years of college, as I was still learning enough Spanish to like relay it to 5-year-olds.
Right, to
like,
be old, just a little bit ahead.
Yeah, just with a Boston accent. Quatre. That's not how it sounds.
Yeah, yeah. The ace. That's actually more Chicago, but
still good.
Yeah.
So I worked in education for years. That was like basically my entire non-comedy work experience.
Until
I worked for my mom until I graduated college, basically. And then I taught preschool for another 4 years in the Boston suburbs in Arlington. And that was wonderful. And I was tutoring. And then I moved to New York and tutored for another 3 years until I was like full-time comedy TV stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was 29. So I've been doing comedy full time since I was 29.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you, I mean, that's in our gendered world, that's a pretty nurturing man.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I'm very maternal.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
I also am. I've said often, because I didn't really have a constant present father role model.
Mm-hmm.
So when I became a father, I think I just mothered. I just did a cis straight male version of mothering, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No. Honestly, yeah. No. I have no qualms with it. I mean, I've never had, you know, like afraid to discuss emotions.
Sure.
Or like, I insist that you model your life after mine.
Right.
You know, like I'm making a little me. Like I never really had that, which I think is probably a more fatherly way to do things.
Yeah. You
know? Generally speaking, it's not a healthy fatherly way.
No, you know? Right. But it's that kind of like traditional masculinity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It also was very professionally advantageous to be a man in that field.
I bet.
Because you just like, when you go to interview, it's like the exact opposite of when a woman interviews in a male-dominated field.
Yes.
Where they're like skeptical and like, are you sure you know how to use the computer? And like when I showed up for preschool interviews, it was always just like, oh, thank goodness one of you is here.
Right, right.
So it's just like, even in this female-dominated space, I was benefiting explicitly from sexism daily.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I mean, it's sort of, and I mean, and this is meant in no way to diminish women in comedy, but women in comedy, because of, not so much now, but certainly when I started, because of their scarcity, there was a higher value on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and there was frequently tokenism, of course, but definitely it's the mirror image of that,
yeah.
You know.
And with women in comedy, I think it also, and not, you know, two guys, we'll chop it up about women in comedy for a while. But you get the like, well, we have the one.
Yes.
Which is like, I think the pernicious way in that works.
Precisely.
Like, the first, in some places it would be like the first woman, like, oh, thank goodness you're here because now you cover our ass for not having women.
Absolutely.
And then the second woman is like, well, you need not apply.
Absolutely. I mean, I work on a show and now we have women writers, but I will say we don't have enough women writers. And for years we didn't have any women writers, and that was not good. And we didn't have any writers of color, and that was not good. And I think especially someone of my age who doesn't kind of get out into the world enough, and there, I believe me, there's a lot of men my age who don't interface as much as, say, like I do. Like, I'm on Twitter. One of the reasons I'm on Twitter is to know what the zeitgeist is.
Yeah.
Basically, and I don't mean that in like a calculated way. I mean it in like a polite way.
Yes, like I'd like to be in step with the world.
Precisely. I want to know that, like, I want to know that that attitude that I hold is now widely panned and that I should re-examine it.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think it's so helpful. And I, like, I get on my high horse about this all the time, but, like, when New York Times columnists or whoever get the thing about, like, people are saying that I'm stupid on Twitter and that just makes me more sure that I'm smart.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Precisely.
It's like, maybe everyone's yelling at you because you're wrong. Yeah. Is that something you'd entertain for one moment?
Everybody likes democracy except for when it comes to their own opinions.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, in comedy, I just think that we felt, and I say we as a general thing, you know, when people started to really talk about representation in a serious way, there's a sense of a white male, like I've made jokes about, like, when you tell a white male that he's wrong about something, it's like murdering him. and in those days, when you get notes about representation, you say, well, who wants tokenism?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, that's true. But also, how else is anything going
to
change?
You have to start.
Unless you take a flyer, you take a leap of faith on somebody that doesn't look like you.
Yeah,
you
know? I think it's so important.
Yeah, yeah.
To have different perspectives represented.
Right.
And like for the sake of that.
Sure, sure.
I think it's really wonderful.
And this is something we should save till later to talk about your current job.
Sure.
Because you certainly, you know, you're a white man running a black show.
Fortunately, there's people above me. I'm supervising producer, which is very exciting. And it's like more influence than I've ever had
in a
show. And it's, but it is like, it is a space where I am very mindful of being deferential and open to opinions that are not, and perspectives that are not mine.
Absolutely.
More than anywhere I've ever worked, because I don't want to be pushing things that are either false or like distasteful.
Certainly.
Or out of step with the people that I work with and the people that I work for.
And as understanding as you can be, as understanding as one in your position can be, you will never understand,
of course,
what it's like to be black.
And there are points at which with things I am like, oh, I think of things this way, but I trust the expertise and the experience of the people around me, and I defer to your judgment and perspective.
Sure. And it's not right or wrong. It's just like what we want to say.
Yeah.
The perspective we want to present.
For sure. Yeah. I think like I was talking with somebody recently about like apologizing. Cause you said like when a white man's opinion is questioned, it's like murdering him, which is like that. And people act like that, right? Like celebrities sometimes, or even non-celebrities who people are criticizing publicly, and there's such a tendency to dig in and be defensive, which I understand.
Yes.
But once you get to the point of like, okay, I understand that I have to deliver an apology of some sort and ideally like change my behavior, like why not just give the best apology? Why like continue to be defensive? Like why give the like, well, I'm sorry you felt that way. Because like once you're at that point, it doesn't hurt more to be like, you know what? I messed up and I'm really sorry. And what I understand that what I did was hurtful, and I'm going to try to do better.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, you lose nothing by doing that. And you gain so much by like exhibiting like a little more contrition.
Right. It's situational, because there are times when I think people, I mean, not necessarily in sort of political correctness, but like there have been times within our show where, because one of my jobs is to give notes, basically, and is to sort of, Conan and I are the end of the quality control. Like everything that goes out the door, the last place it passes is me and him. So, and there are times, and I have a tendency sometimes to be, one could say, brusque.
Sure.
I would think of it as just efficient. And like, I don't need a lot of, if I have an idea that people go like, nah, that's not good, I don't, I'm like, okay, I'll make more. But there are other people that aren't built like me.
Sure.
And that need a little bit more sort of gentleness when you reject their ideas.
Yeah.
And there have been times when people have had issue with that. And I definitely want to show contrition, but I also want to let them know, you know, this is a workplace.
Yes.
We're all making donuts here.
Yes.
And the point is the donuts. And I certainly, I'm sorry if I was neglectful of your feelings, but I will continue to put the quality of the product
totally
a little bit ahead of not of like real feelings, but of just like, come on, you got to get a little thicker skin
for sure. Yeah. I think,
but there again, that's a work thing.
Yes, you know? and that's like a work style issue. It's not, you know, you're not going like, you fucking imbecile.
Yeah.
Out of my sight with that garbage.
Typical broad.
Right. And in that case,
yeah.
Oh boy.
Right.
Wow. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the young Josh.
Sure.
What kind of kid were you?
I was, I think, like a sweet little dweeb.
Yeah.
And I read a lot, and I played sports for like an unexpectedly long time.
Why do you say unexpectedly?
Because I wasn't good at them then.
Yeah.
And to see me now, you would be like, you weren't good at them then. But I played the last kind of like organized sport I stopped playing was I played basketball on the JV team sophomore year in high school.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of, I saw that I'd reached the end of the line. And there was also, I'd started getting really into theater at school. And mm-hmm. So by the time the next basketball season rolled around, it was like I could either participate in the competitive
play.
Drama festival.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah. Or I could try out for the basketball team, probably not make it, maybe kind of make it as like, well, he hustles, but like even then he's not that fast.
Right.
So I gave up with organized sports like junior in high school and then was like all kind of academics, arts, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have one sister.
Uh-huh. Older, younger?
Younger. She's 3 years younger, but we were two grades apart because she was kind of like a smart, pushy toddler.
Yeah.
And so when she was in preschool, she would be like, no, I want to be in that class. And you know, she knows the letters, so what's the harm? And so she just – so we progressed in school 2 years apart. So we – we were in college together for 2 years as well.
Wow.
Yeah, which was cool. We both went to Brandeis.
Do you think that being a big brother was somewhat informed the sort of nurturing nature of yourself?
I think so. Yeah. I think it like fed both ways. Like I think because I'm kind of a nurturing person, I was a better brother, especially as I got older.
Yeah.
And because of doing that, I think I was a little more nurturing. But like I don't think I think I got more big brothery, like, and it's such a, I think, a standard thing that happens to people sometimes. But when we were both in high school together, because I would drive her places. And
yeah.
We, you know, it, my parents kind of, there were times where they would defer to me of like, is this party okay for her to go to? Like, is this going to be a bad scene?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. And so I felt like I was a little more supervisory of my sister.
Yeah. And did she have good judgment anyway?
Yeah, she's like a super good kid. She was a super good kid. She's she's a pediatric physical therapist. She's like a very sweet, wonderful adult person.
Yeah. I have an 18-year-old son, and when he, what people don't realize, and your parents knew it about you, is that the first kid is the first time you've done everything. And so like when he started to get to be the age where he was going to be going to parties, I mean, we're not really restrictive. And I was raised, I mean, our house was the house when I was a kid that everybody drank at.
Sure.
You know, and my parents were kind of like, give me your car keys or don't.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And so because they were just realistic and, you know, like, and my mother, when she was young, she said it wasn't beer. It was like cocktails. They'd come home from high school and have like Manhattans.
That is a sophisticated underage drinking situation.
I also just think that was the time. It was, you know, the 50s.
Yeah.
And I think people just drank cocktails. cocktails. And she remember there was one time where her mother came home, and you know, these are kids sitting around drinking Manhattans and Rob Roy's at 4:30, and her mom came home and they all dumped their drinks in the fish tank and murdered all the fish. Like her mom was like, "Why are all the fish dead?"
It's like, I guess we should have told you we were drinking.
Death by old fashioned. When my son started to go to parties, and we were like, we had no idea, like, are we going to have him in rehab in 6 months? And one of the first parties that he went to that was a friend of his friend, and like a big house party that was crazy and overrun, but the parents were there. Some kid in the backyard brought a taser to tase girls.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And when that happened, my son was on the front porch, and it was north of Ventura Boulevard.
Yeah.
And I just got this call from him on a payphone, because he didn't have his cell phone yet, on a payphone going, "Someone at the party, I think they pulled a knife. Everyone ran." And I just ran down the hill to Ventura. And his friend, he left his friends. And from that point on, I was like, I think it's going to be fine. At the first sign of trouble, he bolted as fast as he could.
That's a good impulse
at
that age.
He's always been very cautious. His friends call him dad.
To tase girls. That's like so fucked up.
Because that's what girls want.
Yeah,
they get tased.
Oof.
But anyway, I think actually the parents got like in legal trouble for that.
That seems not reasonable. Wrong. Yeah,
exactly.
I can't go too hard against that.
Was your dad the nurturing type?
Both of my parents are.
They're does your dad do?
My dad was a he's retired now. He was a glazer, so he installed glass and aluminum, mostly storefronts.
Yeah,
and so even to this day, if we're driving through Boston, he'll go, that hotel I did is still the same.
Yeah,
which is really cool. It like really, I have so much admiration for like the physical imprint he has on like the city and the environment. It's so cool.
Yeah. There's tradesmen in my family too. And it's the same sort of thing. Like my mom is in the kitchen business and she'll be like, I did all the cabinets in that house 25 years ago. Yeah. Yeah.
And like for that stuff to stand up, I mean, you know, everything gets replaced eventually, but like to go, that 25 years ago, I have this connection with this space, even if the cabinets or whatever are different, or the cabinets are still here. Like, what a legacy to have, even if only you think about it.
It's a useful contribution to society and to a family.
Yeah.
You know? So when you started, when you transitioned into being artsy, what was your goal then? What did you think you were going to end up doing at that point? Or did you just, were you still saying like, I'm going to be a teacher?
I think so. I think there were, the goal was some kind of writing.
Yeah.
My grandmother used to say when she would see me in plays, she would say, "You know, you're a really good writer."
Thanks, Grandma.
Which is, I said for years when people read things that I write, you know, if I wrote a freelance piece, they would go, "Hey, that's pretty good. I would like for you to write for us." And when people see me do stand up, they would go, "That's pretty good. You should write for us." So it's like, it was always kind of what I gravitate towards. I always liked doing it. I've always liked writing. And so I started performing, and that was fun too.
Yeah.
But I don't think I ever was like, "Oh, I'm going to be a stage actor."
Right.
As a job.
Yeah.
And when I applied to colleges, I had kind of the unexpected foresight, I guess, to look at schools, to only apply to schools where I could do a creative writing thesis of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought going in, it was going to be playwriting. Because I'd written a play when I was like 17 that had in the like Massachusetts Competitive Drama Festival gotten some recognition. And I was like, "Oh, maybe this is a kind of writing I could do as a job."
Yeah.
And not realizing, I mean, like, you know, I started doing stand-up a couple years later when I was still in college. And numerically, there are just so many more comedians than playwrights.
Sure.
And I had no perspective of that then.
Yeah, yeah.
Where like,
you don't know anything before you go in, you
for
know.
Sure. And
it all seems like magic.
You know? You just like go in and then you come out an adult.
Yeah.
And my sister had even more foresight because when she was finishing high school, she was always like a good student who I think visibly would like care more about some subjects than others. Yeah, and my parents were always a little bit like, well, you got to try at all of them. And she was like, do I?
And that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Math. Why do I need fucking math?
Yeah. It's like we have the calculator's right there. Yes, I can see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's not there, I'll find one.
Right. I'll hire someone to do the math.
And so my parents said, what are you interested in? What field of discipline? And my sister just like very surprisingly to them was like, oh, I'm going to be a physical therapist. And they were like, you've never mentioned that before. And she's like, yeah, but that's what I'm going to do.
How old was she?
She must have been like 16.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then she just did it. And so we both went to Brandeis, but they don't have they kind of pride themselves on not being a pre-professional school, which just means like, if you want to have a career in something that takes more schooling, you have to like take classes outside too. Yeah.
So we're going to teach you to be unemployable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, we'll teach you everything you need to know about literature.
Yeah. We're not into practical
stuff. Yeah. But if you want to study the law, you can do that on your own time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Degenerate. So she had to take like summer. She like planned it out from a very young age. Like, I guess I'll have to take these anatomy courses over the summers. And she just like plotted a course. So I went into college. It's incredible.
Oh.
And that's what, and she just like called her shot as a mid teenager.
I still am not quite sure what the hell I'm supposed to do on this planet. You know, it's just amazing when people know that stuff, you know?
It's so impressive. So I came into college thinking I was going to write plays. And then I just didn't have the like desire to do the kind of backstage practicum stuff, like you wear all black and then you move this to here and then you move that to there. And it's every night for this whole semester. And I was like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So I transitioned into fiction writing. So I wrote a short fiction thesis. So that's like what I built towards in college. But really, like, I was doing improv from freshman year on. After freshman year, I started stand up like in the city of Boston. And then I was doing sketch, like a bunch of friends and I had like a weekly late night sketch show that we just decided we would do and no one told us to stop.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was doing a lot of comedy stuff in school.
I've talked on this show frequently about finding your tribe, and that sounds like,
it was great.
Yeah.
We had these roommates, like it was almost all guys that were just plunked into the same freshman dorm and then kept living together for the ensuing years. And so we had this off-campus house and we would do comedy stuff together. And then my friend Ethan would, once or twice a semester, we would throw a big party and charge at the door and then donate all the money to a charity that he kind of spearheaded looking for that. Like, this is like a very specific, but we did like Hurricane Katrina relief one time. And so it was like kind of, it wasn't a big party school. So, and people would come and it was generally not like that wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was just a bunch of, it was just kind of a bunch of Jews that were like, well, we have to study tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
It never got too out of hand. And that was just kind of like what we did. It was like, and it was the same guys. We would rehearse for sketch and then Ethan would go, we're having a party next weekend. And we go, okay. So we do that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very lovely.
That's when I started doing improv in Chicago, it wasn't even so much. I still to this day, I'm fine with an audience, but they're not who I'm there for.
Yeah.
You know, I'm there for, I've said it before too, like I want to make the cameraman laugh.
Absolutely.
And when our band, when we used to have a band on the show, like if I made the band laugh, I'd be like, all right, I earned my check today.
Oh yeah.
Because the audience, they're strangers.
Yes.
I want to make my family laugh because I know that they're used to my bullshit.
Yes.
They know like my standard issue stuff. So if I can surprise them, I feel like I'm surprising me. And I'm always trying to make me happy. Like that's my showbiz ethos, is like, I'm here being me and enjoying myself. And that's especially, you know, that doesn't work when you're making a movie.
No.
It does still kind of, you know, because I've worked on fun sets and I've worked on not fun sets. And you increase your odds of making a good movie if the set is fun. And I don't care what kind of movie you're making.
That's so intuitive.
You would think. But there's a lot of people that seem very heavily invested in not having fun.
Sure.
But
that's like such a fun and thoughtful way to do it, right? Like the job is to make the audience laugh.
Yeah.
But like the the reason that you get into that job is to make your friends laugh and the people that you respect and enjoy laugh.
Yeah. Well, and also too, because it will come.
Yes.
You have to have faith that this is, if this is your focus in sort of like, it's just such a simple thing of, if you make yourself happy in a way that is in good faith,
mm-hmm.
and in a way that is loving and caring and not intrusive on other people's happiness.
Not at the expense of the audience.
Precisely. But I also mean, in like your life,
oh, sure,
and in your
yeah.
family. If you make yourself happy, you are going to be a lot more successful at making the people around you happy.
Yeah.
Because happiness is a it's a gas that everyone breathes
yes.
in when it starts to really flow. You
totally.
Know?
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places. Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too.
Aww.
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Hi, I'm John Lovett, host of Love It or Leave It. Every week, I'm joined live on stage by incredible guests to break down the biggest and dumbest stories in politics and pop culture. And now, because there's too much news for just one show, join me and my friends, also known as beloved producers who have to be there, every Tuesday for a rundown of the latest headlines to help get you through another flawless week in our perfect society. Listen to episodes of Love It or Leave It wherever you get your podcasts, or catch the funniest moments on the Love It or Leave It YouTube channel.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? So what happens? How do you become, when you started teaching, is that just a day job then? And you're still kind of like really in your head, or you're like, I'm going to make this work, this writing and comedy.
That is kind of what I thought. I thought yeah. I was going to be like a writer of funny books. That's like, you know, kind of like a George Saunders is like the apex
yes.
of what I was
right,
shooting
right.
for at that time. And so I was doing stand-up already and neglecting other writing at the expense of that, or at the for the benefit of my stand-up. So
yeah.
that was like this period where I kind of had this impression of myself as like a writer that hadn't published yet. But really what I was like a comedic performer and writer who was like laying that kind of groundwork.
Yeah.
Like I just didn't have the patience for like submitting to literary magazines. And my parents, who are so supportive, would always say, or my dad took me aside one day and was like, hey, you talk a lot about writing. You know, that's still something you're interested in, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, here, give me $40. And was like, you always talk about needing to find like the places to submit writing that fit your style. So like, take $40, go buy a bunch of literary magazines and like see where you want to submit, which was so generous and specific.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to pay your rent for 6 months so you can be an artist. But it was like, look, you keep talking about this thing, like put it into action. And it like, I think doing that, I did some submitting, but I just liked getting on stage. I liked writing short, funny things. And it just, I didn't have like a lot to say in a literary voice. So I was teaching, and I got my teaching job right after I graduated college. And I stayed at the same place for about 4 years, which was, it was really great. I had an awesome experience. And I had, before I got this teaching job, I was on the phone with my mom, and I'd just been looking for like jobs. Like I truly like, if you stock image search like guy at job, that's like what I pictured myself doing while I was working on this creative stuff on the side. And so I was like looking at banks and like insurance companies, and I was on the phone with my mom being like, yeah, I'm just looking at like jobs. And she's like, well, why don't you get a teaching job? You like that and you're good at it and you will never have to work nights if you're teaching preschool.
Right.
And I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's performing.
Yes, for sure.
It's performing.
It is a lot of performing, yeah. Especially with kids that age, because so much of it is like holding their attention, communicating things in a way that grabs the imagination of people, yeah, who are like so easily distractible.
There are teachers in my family, and I've always my brother's a high school teacher, and he actually ran for Congress in Illinois. And it was, you know, when he said, I'm going to run for Congress, I was thrilled and excited, but also kind of surprised. But then I, oh no, he talks every day.
Yeah.
He's talking to fucking high school kids.
Yeah. That's
so he's
a tough
got a
crowd.
Very hostile audience.
That's a really tough, yeah, crowd.
And I've always thought, There's showbiz around you that you don't notice, and that's teachers and ministers.
Mm-hmm.
They are performing every day.
You know who else gives underratedly excellent performances are like baristas and restaurant servers.
Uh-huh.
Like it is so. Bartenders,
yeah,
for sure. I was at a restaurant and the service was so warm and friendly that I was like, I was like, this is such a pleasure, and it must take so much for the, like, this is their job. That's part of the job. They're, yeah, not just like exceptionally nice people.
Putting,
I mean, they probably are.
They're,
yes,
putting on a show, yeah.
And it's like, that should not go unnoticed and unappreciated.
Yeah.
Like, and so I had so much like gratitude for that part of the experience.
Yeah.
So I taught for 4 years, and it was like, and I tutored all that time as well. And it was like a day job, but it was a day job that I liked. And I brought, at first I kind of felt like I was fiddling with the margins of the job, because there was stuff I would do where like we had 4-year-olds and we would do like little Spanish lessons, and we would do like improv games like that you could kind of scale down for 4-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I would write, like, I was like, oh, do you guys do like is there a performance at the big holiday party? And they were like, well, kind of, but not really. And so I like wrote them a little play. And I, at first it felt like, oh, this is, I'm like skating by. And then I was like, no, this is what I bring to the table.
Yeah.
I'm not like the arts and crafts person, but I can have these kind of dramatic and performative things and the little Spanish stuff around the sides. And the other thing I brought to the table was I worked with almost exclusively women, and I had, for whatever reason, more patience than they did for when little girls would just throw horrific tantrums.
I have, from being a parent, there is an intra-gender intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was shit that my son would do when he was,
yeah,
it's usually in the 13, 14 year old range, where I was like, yeah, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like, come on, snap out of it. And my wife would be a lot more tolerant of it. I have a 13-year-old daughter. It's the same thing where there's stuff that my wife is like, I know exactly what she's doing. It's calculated. And I'm like, oh, you know, it doesn't hit my buttons.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly, yeah, what it was. Because, yeah, when there would be a little boy who would pick up a block, look at another kid 4 feet away, take a running start, and just mush him in the face,
yeah,
I would be like, you little prick.
Yeah.
I saw that in your eyes,
yeah,
and I couldn't get there in time. And they would be like, look, let's take it down. Like, let's make sure he's okay. And I would be like, oh, this kid,
right,
he's going to grow up to boil a cat. Like, I'd be so. And then when it was just a little girl who, for whatever reason, had a different kind of emotional outpouring.
Yeah.
I was the one that would, you know, sit on the floor with them for like 20 minutes and go, hey, I know it's a really hard time. Like, you want this green crayon, but you had to have that green crayon.
Yeah.
And like, we don't always get what we want in life. And that's really, it's so frustrating. And they would be like, how do you do that? And
yeah,
the only answer I could muster was like, when you are a straight male in your 20s, female people, women, and then in this case, girls, but women are just going to cry because you're not good enough at not making people cry yet.
Yeah.
I was just like, enough, even though I tried, I was just like enough of a shithead that like women would cry at me and I, or to me, and I would go, yeah, I deserve this. And you learn to be patient and not just be like, knock it off.
Well, I also think it's a very garden variety neurosis that the things that you do that are sort of gendered, you know, like behaviors that are sort of gendered, that you work to not do them in a way that is intolerant of your own, like, sort of primal, ugly urges. So when you see it mirrored in someone else.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's like you are yelling at yourself.
Yes.
You're like, stop doing that.
And it's the way you're socialized too, right? Like man to boy.
Right.
Of like, and it's also with stuff like that. It's like, oh, I wish that these boys weren't this way. Right. Because I see this like the way that we were socialized to play when I was a kid, of just like smashing each other up. And it's like, it doesn't have to be like that.
Yes. But I know, I also too, I'm not entirely sure if a kid smashing a boy smashing a block into another boy's face, which is a better way to deal with that? Calm or a short, sharp shock? I mean, I don't mean hitting them, but saying like, hey, no.
Yeah.
You know, because certainly in parenting, you learn there are times to explain and there are times to, like I said, the only kind of real corporal punishment my children got was on their eardrums, because as a dad, you learn like that's in your arsenal, in your toolbox. You save that one because you got to learn, you know, like your kids know, like, oh shit, dad's mad.
You are this was dangerous.
Yes.
Someone was at risk here and this cannot happen.
Yes. And it's not like there's a threat of violence, but there certainly is just a sort of like, I'm serious. Listen to me now. Mm-hmm. Because part of being a parent, too, is getting used to not being listened to at all most of the time. So when did you go to New York? I mean, that was probably, I imagine, certainly a step forward in your professional life.
So I moved to New York in 2011 in the summer. And I had had some like a little more success with stand-up at doing festivals outside of Boston. Mm-hmm. And I had seen from the outside looking back in like, oh, and from the inside looking out, like if I want to keep progressing in comedy and writing, I should go where there are more opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. Coming from Chicago, it's the same thing. You got to go, if you're a coal miner, you got to go where the coal is.
Where the coal is, for sure. Yeah. And like, there's also, I think Chicago and Boston are similar.
Very similar.
In that you can go, I'm going to stay and work this local circuit at the highest level, or like aspire to the highest level of this local show business and entertainment, or I could try for a different thing that maybe has like a larger scope.
Right.
And I think I was ready at that time. I'd had enough success to encourage me that like, oh, maybe this could work out.
Yeah.
And I was dating someone who lived in New York and just everything kind of lined up of like, oh, this is a good move for my life and my career. So I moved in 2011 and my tutoring office transferred me and I stopped teaching full time. So I was tutoring several hours a week.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really nice. It was so fortunate. And,
yeah.
And they, I got called in it like maybe 8 months into being in New York, maybe a year. They called me into the office and I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. They like never want, because it was mostly in-home visits.
Yeah.
And so I was like, why would they call me in the office? And they were like, we really like the way you communicate to like the younger kids on the spectrum, like the 11, 12, 13 year olds, as opposed to the 15, 16, 17 year olds preparing for college.
Yeah.
And they were like, do you have any like tips on this? We want to like move you to like a senior level tutoring position.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And so the hourly rate was good enough tutoring. And I was on the road a little bit doing stand up and I would like Skype session with some of my kids, which was like very fortunate that technology existed by then.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was doing a little freelance writing for like mostly women's magazines and other magazines as well, but like internet stuff, you know, a couple $100 here, a couple $100 there, and was kind of piecing together a living where the tutoring made sure my rent was paid and my bills were paid. And then the other stuff was like growing enough that it felt like several side jobs as opposed to like, oh, these are my fun creative hobbies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was kind of 2011 the last half of 2011, 2012, 2013 was a lot of that.
Yeah.
And it was great. And so the thing that kind of pivoted into like from side job to career was in late 2012, my friend Jack Moore and I co-created this very popular viral Twitter account.
Yeah.
The modern Seinfeld Twitter account.
Yes.
Which was just the premises like, what if Seinfeld, but it now
continued.
And
yeah.
It was, you know, it was just like a fun hobbyish thing that we were doing.
Yeah.
And people, it seemed to click with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that kind of gave me it was the first time I was ever like, oh, you're that guy. You're that guy who did this thing that I liked. Instead of like, oh, your stand-up was funny. Like, good to meet you. See you around.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it gave me all these opportunities and I'd started applying for jobs, mostly in late night. And I did that for like a year. 2013 was just like packet after packet, submission materials for different late night shows. Got hired or did a little tiny bit of work for Billy on the Street, which was like very encouraging and fun.
Yeah. And whoa, boy.
He's so funny.
Oh, just the best.
He had like his fastball is faster than just about anybody.
Absolutely.
You know, he's just like,
yeah.
He has a gear that people don't have.
Yeah. And he's just delightful.
Wonderful.
He's magical.
He's so great.
Yeah.
And so I did a little of that. And that was kind of like in the summer doldrum when I was like, oh, maybe the height of where I get is like gets to apply to jobs.
Yeah.
And then I did that and I was like, ooh, maybe gets jobs is in my repertoire as well. And then the beginning of 2014, I started working at Last Week Tonight doing their like web, social, digital stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I did that for a year. And
how long a day is that?
So they were the days on the show are pretty humane.
Yeah.
But it was weekends too, was part of it. So we were like 10 to 6 in the office. And then if you were working on a long script or a script that you got assigned late in the day for that week's show, you might have to work into the evening. And especially early on, I think it took a little while for to figure out like how long these long scripts took to write or like how long they were even going to be.
Yeah.
Because I think they, over the first several months, like the main stories that they do on the show are, you know, 16, 18, 20 minutes. And that's a lot of writing.
Yeah.
And I think as that expanded, they recalibrated like, oh, this is the amount of lead time we need so people aren't staying at the office super late.
That's so nice.
It's really nice.
There's a lot of places they don't give a shit.
Yeah, they go, well, it's more convenient for us to assign it to you at 3 p.m.
Yes.
And then you stay till 3 a.m.
I always think that the secret ingredient to a show with, as you put it, humane hours is someone in charge who has a happy home life. Mm-hmm. Because people with unhappy home lives, they're going to keep you there till 2 o'clock in the morning because they don't want to go home.
Oh, yeah. And all three of the EPs had like families and children that they like.
Yeah.
And so it was like, it was very nice because you knew that they had things they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it's lovely. And
it makes them considerate of other people.
It's very nice.
Yeah.
And so I did the digital and web stuff there for a year and then moved over and wrote for the show for 4.
Are you a topically minded comedian?
I think my stand up isn't super topical.
Yeah, that's why I asked.
But
stand up is more just sort of existential.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little personal. It's a little just like what is fascinating me at the time.
Yeah.
Especially topical stand up, I feel like unless you can get it on TV really fast, with the pace that the news moves now,
it's
it's not durable.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to like, especially those years in Boston where I was only doing stand up and not writing other stuff, it kind of taught me like, oh, but to make something that holds it like a script that you can have. And whenever someone says, do you have a script that you like? You're like, oh, I have this one that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
Like something durable that you can take place to place. And topical stuff, I think just doesn't always have that like lasting power because the news, you go, hey, Rick Perry is the Secretary of Energy. And people are like, what? There's 100 other things. I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm newsy minded and like kind of the social issues of the day minded. And that's like what I think about more. So I liked working on it and I learned a lot about like who these people are. Like I didn't know, cause I read most of my news. I don't like watch, but it like, that's what it took. Like working there for 5 years. I was like, oh, that's who does the news now.
Yeah.
Cause you would watch the footage and go, oh yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all showbiz.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you are married to a very talented writer, too.
I am.
And,
yeah.
And tell me how you guys met.
So we met. Maris Kreisman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we knew of each other. She's a brilliant person and a brilliant writer. And we were acquainted lightly over the internet. And then a mutual friend brought me to a party she was throwing. She was like, she had this long running blog that had a lot of followers and like specifically, I think all over the place, but like, she was very plugged in and is very plugged into the like literary scene.
Yeah.
And especially in New York, there were a lot of friends and peers and fans.
Yeah.
And so she, because she worked in publishing for a long time. So she was having a 5-year anniversary party for this blog, Slaughterhouse 90210, that she ran for years. And it was, it's very funny. And it was just like a picture, a screen grab from a pop culture event or moment or institution, and then a quote from literature. And that's like exactly her sensibility as a consumer of things. Yeah. Like she just wants
the sublime and the ridiculous. Yeah.
She just wants to know like, what would Toni Morrison have to say about Jane the Virgin? Right. Yeah. And like, can we put these two things in conversation? And I think that that's, so we met at this party and we made a date for, we got along immediately, made a date for the following. It was like a stone cold sober 9 a.m. breakfast date that weekend because I was about to leave town and I had said, so I, the only cool thing I've ever done in my life got me married, which was we met at this party and she said, what's new with you? Cause we knew of each other enough that we weren't like, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah.
And she goes, what's new? And I go, I just got booked for this stand up gig in Sweden and I'm very excited. And she goes, I want to go to Sweden. We'd had a couple drinks and she goes, I want to go to Sweden. And I said, well, give me your phone number. We'll hang out once in America first to make sure we don't hate each other. So I had her phone number from that moment. And, we parted ways after the party and I texted her the next day and I said, hey, I had a really good time talking with you last night. Let's hang out before enough time passes that it's weird that we haven't hung out yet. And so we like 2 days later or 3 days later, we had like a stone cold sober second date or first date breakfast.
Yeah.
And then we've just been dating since then.
Yeah.
And
got married. Did she go to Sweden with you?
She did not go to Sweden.
Okay. Because I was going to say, wow, that
would have been incredible.
Wow. But also, too, like, that's a big swing.
A big commitment. Yeah. Yeah. No. And also, my immediate family, my parents had, I think, never been to Europe. I also had not at that point.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, I'm going for work. You guys should come because you never take trips this big and you, I think, had just retired or about to. And I was like, just come. It's like, everybody's going to speak English. It'll be easy.
Was it just Sweden?
We went to London for 2 days afterwards or 3 days afterwards, which was awesome. Yeah. And that was, I think, like even more their speed because it was like a cool, different cultural experience, but without kind of the stress of like, what are those letters and punctuations?
Yeah, yeah.
Which me too.
Yeah.
I'm like, I get so nervous about international travel where I'm like, oh, but I don't know Italian. And it's like, and I feel so self-conscious of the idea of like going from a phrase book or an app. Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Buongiorno.
Yeah. Yeah. The first time, cause I never traveled. And then shortly after, it was probably like 1994 or so. And my sister-in-law was working as an au pair in France, and we flew to Paris to meet her. And when we landed, I had like a panic attack of like, I don't speak the language here. What happens if I get separated from everyone? And I was like, well, what happens? And I was like, you have a credit card.
Yes.
You get on a plane and go home.
Yeah, for sure.
Like it's not, you don't have to, but there definitely was that fear of, you go to a foreign land. But now, now it's kind of like, every time we went to Italy last summer and I signed up for some app because it's like, I know a little bit of restaurant Italian, but I was like, I'm going to do more. And I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Fine.
We went to Greece for our honeymoon and I truly, I've talked about it on stage, but truly was blown away because I did no preparation. I didn't even really consider it till I got on the plane. And like from the airplane Wi-Fi, I downloaded a translation app and I punched in one word and I was like, I don't even know what these letters sound like. Like, how do you say pie? Like, is it pih?
Yeah,
And I was just like, I fully punted.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I'll point at things for a week.
Yeah.
I'm not prepared for this.
We've covered a lot of where you come from.
Yeah.
Now let's go to what's next for you? I mean, are you a set goals kind of person?
I tried to set goals, but I also try to be more open to like going with the flow.
Yeah.
Because I think I set short-term goals. That's what I'm pretty good at. I'm good at setting short-term goals and generally achieving them.
Yeah.
So like I'm pretty good at going, I want to write this project and get it done in roughly this period of time.
Yeah.
I don't have like a true 5-year plan where it's like in 5 years, I want to be doing this kind of thing and I'll just make my way and manifest it into the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm a lot better at being like, well, I need a new 5-minute tape so I can send it out to television bookers and I can do another set on television.
Yeah,
and that's like
yeah.
something that feels very manageable to me.
Right. Exactly. It's like instead of, you're laying tracks for a train.
Yes.
That's one rail at a time, yep. you know, so that makes sense.
And then I go, oh, there's a mountain there. I guess my track goes this way now.
Or up and over, yeah. however. Yeah.
Right, that's true. But yeah. I'm like not – I don't have that kind of like vision and confidence to like look towards the mountains and be like, it's going to be a train through you, motherfucker.
yeah. No, I still am – one of the things that I struggle with is – the goals that I would have and the things, because forever, I mean, I have a attention deficit issues, and there's nothing sort of more daunting to me than a blank page.
Yeah.
And, or the question, and this is a sort of a more deeper philosophical thing. What do you want? What mm-hmm. do you want to say? I'm like, I don't know. I've been busy worrying about what other people want. Mm-hmm. And so there, something that I struggle with is that I have these, you know, like I should be more of an author. I should be writing things. Mm-hmm. I should be – I've had this pressure that I put on myself over that. And I don't know. Like maybe that's not who I am. Maybe
yeah.
I'm an actor. Maybe I'm just mm-hmm. – maybe I am just an improviser actor. And I don't mean just. I mean
– right. These are my lanes
yeah,
that I like to work in.
Exactly. And I think sometimes too – and I don't – I think it's a fairly normal thing. I – tend to discount the things that come easily to me.
I think creative people do that a
yeah.
lot. And there's, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's working on like she's like finishing grad school and working on a thesis. And she was like kind of lamenting that she doesn't write a certain way or doesn't easily write a certain way. And it's like it doing the thing that is natural to you. Like doing the thing that, like, if you have to really stress and strain to make something work and like, oh, I wish I could write magical realism. Maybe it's like an interesting exercise to try.
Yeah.
But like if what you write is like really propulsive crime drama and that feels stupid to you because it's easy. It's like it's not stupid because it's easy. It is a gift that
yeah.
you can do that in a natural way and make something really compelling for
yeah.
people in a way that doesn't feel like laboring
yeah.
Or like you know, making your muscles move in an unnatural way.
And I also think, too, you have to listen to other people. You know, there's a lot of there tends to be a sort of an opinion that, you know, you can't define yourself based on other people's opinion of you. But it certainly is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's things that I do and plenty of things that I do that I'm like, I don't know. Is this good? Is this not good? And people tell me it's good.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I'm in show business is because there was enough people told me, oh, no, you're good at this.
Yeah.
And so I believed them because mm-hmm. I had no sense of whether or not I could believe myself
yeah.
in terms of it. Yeah.
So in terms of goal setting, it's like there are certain things that I've been kind of trying to work towards for a little while that I'm like, I still have this goal and it just feels like I'm maybe inching closer to it. Like I'd love to do a longer form stand-up special and sell that to a network.
Yeah.
That's like something that is like a big goal that's been looming for a while that I'm kind of hopefully closing in on little by little. And then the next thing, and not to be too pluggy, is I have a book coming out this fall.
I certainly wanted to talk about it. Yeah.
Thank you. And that was something where it really felt like I had co-written a book before that was more of like a straight humor book. Like
mm-hmm.
it was like an etiquette guide to like, you've already screwed this up. Here's how you fix it.
Uh-huh.
And this, so, and that was, it came out in 2015, 2014.
Look it up, folks.
Out, yeah.
What does it matter?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
So it came out in 2014. And then I waited a little while because I like don't sit down at a blank page and go like, here are the 5 brilliant ideas that I have.
Uh-huh.
And like, get ready, world, because I'm about to set you on fire. And so it took me a little while to go, okay, this is what I want. Like, because a book takes, it's almost in the way like a film does.
Yeah.
From the time you're like, here's the idea for it, it's years until it reaches completion. So I had the having done a book in the past with my co-wrote with my friend Joe Berkowitz, who's an excellent writer as well. Mm-hmm. I'm also excellent.
Go right ahead.
There we go.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a safe space.
Thank you. So I had the experience and the wisdom of like, oh, I'm going to have to sit with this for a long time. So I better be really sure that if I'm doing this while I have a day job and while I'm performing, that it's something that I'm going to be motivated to like work on the weekends or work on at night. And so I spent probably a long time relatively just refining the proposal into something that my literary agent, Noah, who's awesome, was like, yeah, this is a thing that people will be interested in and you can sell it and it'll be like worth the time of going out with it and writing it and putting it into the world.
Yeah.
So we tweaked that for a long time. And then it sold, the proposal sold in late September, early October, 2017. Mm-hmm. And then it took 11 months to write the first draft. And then, you know, and then there's been like various stages of edits, and then I recorded the audiobook, and now I'm in like working on just like writing essays to support the book to publish places, like, mm-hmm. pitch an op-ed to the Times or something. And it's like, well, I wrote all my ideas. They're in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like working on that, and it's been, I think, because of the time that I spent refining the idea, and then my editors like expert eye and notes and guidance, that it's been a really cool, rewarding process. And it's a book of comedic personal essays.
Okay. Yeah. And what's it called?
It's called Nice Try: Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results.
Nice.
So I'm like really psyched about it. And I'm trying to, my agent had said to me a couple months ago, like, would you like to try to sell another book before this comes out? Kind of like riding the wave of like pre-publication goodwill.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have the idea that I was like, I'm ready to jump in and sit with any idea that I have in my head for another 2 years right now. So like, I'm trying to stay really present and not go like, I wrote this book, so it's done and now I have to do the next thing. I'm trying to really sit with it and like be enthusiastic, because sometimes it's hard to cheerlead for your own work because you're like, is it grotesque?
Yeah.
Is it grating on people? But I really worked hard on it, and I'm trying to give myself the like permission to tell people that, and that I think they would like it and that I'm proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just sit with it for a while. Mm-hmm. Don't like, you know, it's still your baby and it's getting out into the world before you start thinking about the next kid.
Yeah. You know? And I also like I like doing the live events, like the tour events and the launch events. That's like part of the joy of like creating something to me.
Yeah.
And I know I have author friends who, that's something they do because it's part of the job. But I'm like very much looking forward to like, okay, I'm going to go
book tour.
I'm going to go up to Boston on a Tuesday night and do an event there. And it'll be like a real fun hometown thing. And then I'm going to do a Philly, a different Tuesday, and like see and do a stand up show and sell books after that. And I have live events in New York that people are going to come to. And I'm like pretty extroverted, so I'm pretty energized by that possibility. Like I don't have that dread that I think some people who are like primarily
authors,
yeah, or even TV writers who don't perform as much, the dread of like, oh, I have to talk to all these people, which will like kind of slowly deplete my energy level. Like I get tired.
I have to be looked at.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And just like everyone's gaze takes 0.1% out of me.
Yeah.
And I understand that. And I think that's so valid. But this is a fortunate part of the process for me where I'm like, cool, my other favorite work thing to do is just to go out. And like, I'm from doing stand-up, I'm like a pretty capable live performer. And I have a pretty good sense of like what audiences want from a live event and how to tailor that, because sometimes you see people who don't do a lot of like live talking and they read 20 minutes of a very dry section of a poem. Like I went to a reading in college, I remember, and I like love, it was this poet and I loved his work on the page, and I was so psyched that he was coming to campus, and I fell asleep in the like archives room of the library listening to him, because I was like, oh man, you are bringing there's nothing that I'm getting from hearing you.
Yeah.
It's taking away from like the beauty of the words.
It's showbiz, buddy.
Yeah. 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 It's showbiz.
Yeah. something that you do that is a lovely thing that is that you give pep talks on Twitter. Tell me how that started and tell me the thought behind it. And I also am curious if like there has been nice outcomes of that that you've heard, where just those that exchange of words has manifested itself in a good way.
Sure. So it started, I was in kind of like a career slump. It felt like it was a few months before I got hired at Last Week Tonight. And I had that kind of like explosive viral Twitter success. And then I just a couple things fell apart on me at this time. Like, you know, I was having these meetings that came from that I was not super well equipped for or prepared for in terms of like, I wish I had like a killer feature script to show people or a killer pilot that I was like, this, let's make it. And I just like that kind of writing, I was lagging behind on that.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of had a bunch of pleasant meetings where people are like, cool, well, let us know when you got something. And I was like, well, I don't got something. And then a couple of little things that I thought I had lined up kind of fell away. And then so one day I had this gig that I was supposed to do in New Haven, and I was getting ready to get in my car and drive the hour and 40 minutes. And the guy that booked me was like, hey, the venue's doors are like dead bolted shut, and there's not like enough tickets sold that we should like move it to somewhere else.
Yeah.
So like, we're just going to call it because I can't get into this building. And I was just like, well, fuck me then. Like, I can't even do this $200 gig that I was like, well, at least I know how to do this.
Yeah.
And I was feeling kind of like low and needy. And I thought like, I have enough of a presence and a following online that I could have asked for someone to do something nice for me. Just like, hey man, I'm not feeling great. Is there somebody that can reassure me that things are probably fine?
Yeah.
And I thought about doing that, but I was like, if 5,000 people or whatever, 15,000 people at the time followed me on Twitter, I didn't need to ask 15,000 people for something nice, because like, I didn't need that kind of influx of like, yeah, buddy, it's fine.
Yeah.
And it might've been late at night enough too, that I was like, I couldn't just call a friend, you know, of college friend or something. And so instead of asking for it, I was like, what if I did that for someone else? I bet there's other people that are feeling the way I'm feeling right now.
Yeah.
And if I intellectually know that many things are fine that don't feel fine, or many things that aren't fine can get better.
Yeah.
So I was like, if I can offer that kind of encouragement to someone else, maybe that'll feel good in the same way. So I tried it, and I probably got like a couple dozen requests and kind of handled those, and it felt really good. And it's especially something that I can do, like if I'm on the road and by myself, it's like a really nice way to feel connected to people. Or like if I've just had a long day, and by the time I get home from doing a stand-up set, Maris is asleep and Busy, our fat pug, is asleep. And so it's just like a nice way to feel connected to people without like the intrusive thing of like, who can I text at midnight that it's not going to seem like it's either urgent or like I'm trying to have an affair. You know what I mean? And so it's like a nice way to reach out to like, hey, who's around? What can I do something for you? And the outcomes have been, there have been really lovely ones, just that like nothing huge. Like, I don't think I've changed anyone's life, but usually there's some follow-up, or often there's follow-up where someone will go, hey, I had this job interview and you had told me like, just go in, like you're not there by accident. They want to see you. So just like go in and do you. And they're like, and I got the job, and it meant a lot that you like were encouraging about that.
Yeah,
and just like
yeah.
little things, like I didn't get them the job, but it's nice to say a nice thing and have someone like instill someone with that feeling.
Yeah.
Or like, I mean, a thing that I tell people a lot, cause you get a lot of kind of the same requests when people have specifics, are just like, the news feels really bad and the world feels really bad. And one thing that I tell people a lot is like, it is bad. Good night. It is bad, but like, you can be one of the people who makes it better. Like,
yeah.
We all can.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
And there are people that can make, that will help you make it better for yourself and for others.
Yeah.
And like, that is, so when, talking about where am I going? I think one of the things that I am trying to like really center in the work that I'm doing is like, what am I doing to make things better? And like, how am I helping people? And how am I making work with intention rather than just like, does this get a laugh? Then I will do it.
Yeah.
And so that's like a way that I'm trying to orient myself big picture.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's really, I mean, it's a lovely thing to do. And also it's one of those examples of, you know, everybody shits on Twitter. Everybody, yeah. You know, everybody shits on Twitter, but here you sit with, you are a going concern. You are, you know, your career is growing.
Well, thank you.
You have so many great things ahead of you, and you can credit some of that to this silly Twitter
thing.
For sure.
And even like the ability and the familiarity when I met my now wife for the first time, that we were familiar with each other enough that we could talk and she wasn't like, who's this weirdo?
Yep.
And I wasn't like, why would I go to this party?
Yep.
The way I say it in the book too, but I say like, Twitter is like really harsh on a lot of people. And as like, you know, a straight, cisgendered, white man, I don't get the worst of it by a long shot.
Certainly.
And so I don't want to discount that. But like, so Twitter is kind of like I fell into an open sewer and found $100.
Yeah.
And that's my career. And then I fell into the same sewer again and found a diamond ring.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, look, I get that this is a sewer, but I've had like a lot of luck falling into this sewer.
And I have. It has enriched my life.
Yeah.
I have friends, like real serious,
absolutely,
in real life friends that I've made through this. And I know so many people, especially women, who are now comedy professionals because they got on Twitter.
Yeah.
And somebody could see, everybody saw, this is a funny person.
Yeah.
And then somebody takes a risk on them, hires them, and now they have comedy careers.
Yeah, it's very cool.
And I also think for a particular kind of person, a joke thinking, joke writing person, I know, like there are people on Twitter I've never met, but I know them because I have a mind that thinks of jokes. They have a mind that thinks of jokes.
Yep.
And it's like a blood test, or it's like a, like it's just, it, you sense, I know who that person is just from their jokes,
yep,
you know, because it's a language that I understand.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, we're getting towards the end here. We're to the, what have you learned part? I mean, you know, I think it's fairly safe to say you've learned that kindness is a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I've learned, that's one of the things, I mean, like the overarching narrative of the book is that like, I was a nice kid, and like niceness and kindness and goodness are not always synonymous.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to like move in my life and work from like just niceness of like, hey, good to see you, buddy, to like kindness of like, hey, is there anything I can do for you?
Yeah.
And goodness of like, what am I doing for the world? And like, and especially now that I have a little more in terms of resources of like a platform and a little more financial stability in my own life and like career stability, where I don't feel like I have to constantly be clamoring to make things happen for myself.
Yeah.
Like, how can I do for others? And I think like, I'm trying to be better about being like assertive or like righteously indignant and like calling bullshit on things that are bullshit, as opposed to being like, I don't know, they're probably having a hard day, and like, which is also an important impulse.
Sure.
But like, to not just like let people being an asshole slide, but to do that with like tenderness and gentleness, I think,
yeah,
is like what I'm, that's like my human being brain project.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you are definitely somebody that puts a lot of goodness into the world.
Thank
and that's
you.
That's a wonderful thing. And I mean, when you talk about that, you're going to Sweden and you tell your parents to come with you, like, that's a pretty one, like, you obviously are very well loved.
Oh, thank you.
And that is much credit to your parents and to your family. And I mean, and it's really wonderful that that's what you put out into the world.
Thank you.
And, because, you know, I mean, comedy can be very navel gazy, mm-hmm, and people can sort of create their own feedback loop of what they do with their comedy. And yours is so expansive and so kind of outward reaching, and it's about doing goodness. And I think that that's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, this was such a pleasure.
I'm glad.
Thank you for having me.
And I urge people to go out and get your book. Tell me the name one more time.
Nice Try: Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results.
Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for listening. And we will see you next time on The Three Questions. Bye-bye. Big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Becton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.